Hopefully, if you're listening to this, you are full. Or spent some time with family, volunteered to feed others, thought about what you have and what you're thankful for. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, in our post-Thanksgiving show, we are thankful to have a bunch of great contributors to help us make sense of our current economy. That includes talking about the president-elect's policies and businesses, the shopping that some of you are no doubt doing, how that fits into our economic health, and, you know, food. What to do with it now besides a boring turkey sandwich. No offense to sandwiches, but come on. We are thankful for our listeners, and you can talk with us on marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are going to start the show, as we generally do, with our segment Long and Short. We've borrowed those terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. This week, to go long and short, we have Marketplace's own Andy Euler and Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We are going to start in the realm of politics and political news, but in a sort of 30,000-foot view. Nancy, let's actually start with your short.
I am going short on the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress being able to completely overturn the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. They are going to try. They want to change the way banks and non-banks are labeled systematically important financial institutions, you know, too big to fail. Right now, the threshold for that is if a bank has more than $50 billion in assets, then they're considered a SIFI, a systematically important financial institution. These banks, they have to set aside more capital. They're subject to more regulation. Small banks have said, hey, $50 billion, actually, that's a pretty small bank, believe it or not. So they don't want to be regulated like that as a systematically important financial institution. So Republicans and President Trump will definitely try to change that. And that's a big part of Dodd-Frank, and they would need to go through Congress to do that. And here's why I'm short on this. Here's why I don't think they're going to be able to make major changes to Dodd-Frank, because the Republicans in the Senate don't have a big enough majority to avoid a Democratic filibuster. And some Democrats, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, feel very strongly they don't want big changes in Dodd-Frank.
Well, and this is one of those things when we think about the incoming policies and upcoming policies of President-elect Trump and his administration, we are in the stage where lots of proclamations and promises are made. But Nancy, as you're pointing out, this stuff comes up against procedural walls in Washington.
Yeah, that's true, Lizzie. But I do want to, I want a little caveat here,
okay.
Which is President-elect Trump will appoint very different people to the federal regulatory agencies in charge of implementing the rules on Dodd-Frank. Mm. So let's just say there are some rules that may not be implemented completely or may not be implemented at all. I'm talking about things like limits on executive pay. And there's also been a push to have corporations disclose their political donations. And those things aren't going to happen. They're just not going to be implemented by the agency heads that Trump appoints.
Andy, I want to stay in this regulatory and policy realm,
right,
if we will, and go with your short, because I think it kind of fits in here.
It actually dovetails really nicely with what Nancy was kind of talking about. We heard on a YouTube video about some of the things that President-elect Trump is trying to implement in the first 100 days that he'll be in office. And one was about energy. He said he's going to cancel job-killing restrictions on the production of American energy. What I'm short on is the idea that these restrictions and these regulations are actually going to affect oil and gas in the United States. Federal regulation doesn't actually carry a whole lot in terms of oil and gas regulation here in the United States. There are a few air quality regulations now that are being exercised. And that was a big win for the Obama administration. And so you can ratchet that back a little bit. But more or less, it's the states that decide how much oil and gas they produce and what the restrictions they put on oil and gas. Well, even if federal regulations are ratcheted back and we get rid of a lot of things like Donald Trump said that he was going to do in his first 100 days, I just don't think it's going to have all that big of an effect because the market's going to have an effect.
Here is the price of oil that really drives this.
And, you know, if the price of oil, if the price of gas stays super low, there's just no impetus to produce more than what we're already producing. And then you throw OPEC in there, and then you throw Russia in there, and if we're thawing relations with Russia and they start being allowed to produce more oil and gas, then there's just too much out there. So the market's going to dictate what we're doing. I just don't think, you know, if we ratchet back these restrictions, it's going to do a whole lot for oil and gas here in the U.S.
We're going to pivot now big time from the world of the political to the other thing that is sort of occupying people's holiday weekends. Nancy, hit it.
All right. Well, I am going long on consumers spending more on their holiday shopping. The National Retail Federation, which is very interested in how much people spend on the holidays, they are forecasting a 3.6% increase in holiday shopping this year. We're also, according to the National Retail Federation, going to be spending more online. Online sales are expected to increase by 6 to 10%. Number of reasons for this, Lizzie. Consumer confidence is up. Unemployment is down. And our finances are in pretty good shape. We've paid down our bills. And, you know, we're looking pretty good. And apparently, we're ready to spend.
Okay, so, Andy, your long is about all of the food that is sitting around everybody's house right now?
Yeah, we're probably, even if you planned right, you're probably still inundated with a lot of leftovers. Most of us probably have a few leftovers still sitting around. So there are some apps, which I think this is such a cool idea. There was an app that was started in Denmark for restaurants to sell their leftovers to consumers at a discounted rate. A lot of them are about an 80% discount. There's a group in the U.S. It's called Food for All. They say they're trying to reduce food waste here in the U.S. Because about 40% of the food that's produced here goes to waste. That's like restaurants and caterers and cafeterias and things like that. I think the idea is really great. The problem is there are a few problems here. A lot of it has to do with liability.
And local health codes.
Sure, exactly. And so you have to figure all of that out before this just becomes an app you pull up on your phone and you say, oh, okay, cool, I'll go to this restaurant and get this sweet, maybe a little bit old food for 80% off or something like that.
Oh, my God. My father hears this. I mean, this is like his dream.
But
cheap leftovers.
I worked at a restaurant for 8 years, and we would do the exact same thing. I mean, we had bread that we would actually pack it up and give it away. That kind of implies some things, too. You know, the management didn't really want us doing that. There was a lot of weird kind of economics and moral issues with just giving food away. So if you could figure out a way to do it and actually monetize it for the restaurant and for people who are looking, you know, maybe to get some cheap, decent food, I think that's just kind of a great idea. So I don't know. I hope it makes its way here in the U.S. It's doing pretty well in Europe. But we'll kind of see with all these leftovers that we have this weekend.
Marketplace's Andy Euler and Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
No, thank you, Lizzie.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
Maybe you woke up before dawn the other day for the retail running of the bulls known as Black Friday. But I'm guessing a lot of you are waiting for Monday, what's been branded Cyber Monday. You heard Nancy say shopping this year could be strong. In 2015, shoppers spent $3 billion on Cyber Monday. We brought in our friend, CNET's editor-in-chief Lindsay Turrentine, to talk about how retailers approach this big day online. It's good to have you back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you again. So when we think about Cyber Monday, if you are a big business or even a little one, how are you approaching it?
you're thinking about all of the millennials who are going to be shopping on their phones on Cyber Monday. Cyber Monday has turned out over the past few years to be the largest online shopping day of the year. Wow. And it keeps growing every year. We did our own survey at CNET, and we found that 90% of our readers are going to at least browse on Cyber Monday. And 95% of millennials who use CNET plan to buy gifts on Cyber Monday. So if you're thinking about how to position all of your wares, you're really thinking like, okay, what is this going to look like online? Are people going to be able to purchase it easily from their phones? Are they going to be able to share it with their friends if they think it's cool? That's the kind of thinking that's going to yield successful Cyber Monday sales.
Well, and to flip that around, if you're on the other side, if you are a consumer, what can you do in advance to think, okay, I want to get the best price. Let me make sure I do that before you're suddenly like, ooh, flashy sale.
Well, a lot of retailers are not advertising their Cyber Monday sales way in advance. They've sort of will often wait until the last minute to see what they can swoop in with after they do all the math from Black Friday. Now, that said, you can definitely look at the major sites and certainly Amazon ahead of time to get a sense for what Amazon is advertising now. And then often Amazon will sell out of that stuff immediately, but you'll get a good sense from looking at Amazon ahead of time for what to look for elsewhere and how to price match.
I look at a lot of this with like a very raised eyebrow, and I guess I'm curious, like, are you getting a deal online, or you know, if you can, should you just kind of wait a couple of weeks and see if things shake out? You know, do people get seduced by the positioning of all of this as an event itself?
Well, this, of course, has the world's most aggravating answer, which is it depends. You know, there are some deals that really can only be had on Black Friday or Cyber Monday and probably won't roll around again unless a retailer sees that its sales are slumping and it hasn't met the expectations that it set for itself.
Are these promotions sort of something that translates across the board? Like, do they exist for businesses? You might not expect them to. Hotels, airlines, things like that, you know, not your traditional electronics retailer.
That's a great question. Some online businesses will really do a push on Cyber Monday just because they know that you're out there paying attention to prices and that customers are thinking about getting deals. That said, it really tends to be the domain of traditional retailers. And some people say that the best clothing and soft goods deals come on Cyber Monday, and that it's a particularly good time to shop for clothes, coats, ski clothes, things like that.
So this is my moment to, like, buy socks to disappoint my family in their Christmas stockings?
That's right. All the socks you want, Cyber Monday.
Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief of CNET, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Over the past two shows, we've examined several potential policies under President-elect Donald Trump. And we'll keep doing that as we learn more about them. But now we're going to turn to his businesses. And to be clear, we don't actually know how extensive they are because he has not released his tax returns. But we do know that there are many potential conflicts of interest between his businesses and role as president. Trump has said he will put his interests in a blind trust, but then that his children will oversee his businesses, making them not a blind trust. Since the election, he named his three oldest ones to his transition team, met with developers from a project in India, and his daughter Ivanka accompanied him to a meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. So, what does the law say about how Trump should handle his businesses? Ken Gross leads the political law practice at the firm Skadden. And when you talk about how business and politics intersect, he's the guy. Ken, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Is there like a standard operating procedure for someone assuming the presidency, particularly when they are wealthy and have sort of vast financial holdings?
Well, I don't know if there's a standard operating procedure for this because this situation is unprecedented. But any president coming into office develops a code of ethics and immediately turns his attention to, or at least the staff turns his attention to, any ethical issues. In this case, of course, the challenges are unprecedented. First of all, we've never had a president come from the private sector as a businessman directly, who's never been in the government. He filed paperwork with the Federal Election Commission, Donald Trump, showing ownership in over 500 businesses. And we don't really even know what these businesses are. You know, when we've had wealthy people go into office like Mike Bloomberg, we knew what Bloomberg Business was. But these businesses are something like DJT Mark IV or DJT Qatar or Shanghai or whatever. You know, we know the value in range, but we don't really have a complete picture of what these holdings are and what conflicts of interest might arise.
Well, you're a lawyer. I mean, the legal rules around this seem kind of fuzzy. Like, do we have to?
There are a couple of laws that come into play, but the main law that confronts an individual when he or she enters the executive branch of the federal government, whether they're the Secretary of Energy or the Secretary of Treasury or on down, has to comply with strict conflict of interest laws administered by the Office of Government Ethics. Hmm. However, as your question suggests, the president and the vice president is exempt from those laws because his position and his responsibilities are so broad that it would be very difficult to say, okay, you have to sell this or have to sell that. You know, when a secretary of treasury comes in, you can't own stock in a financial services firm. If you're an energy secretary, you can't own stock in an oil company. But when it comes to the president, it's not possible to really do that in a practical way. So they just exempted the president. So the Office of Government Ethics rules do not apply to Donald Trump.
Wow.
Yeah. There are some laws out there. Of course, you know, you can't trade for profit on confidential information. There are bribery laws, honest services fraud laws that all apply. But there's one that's really interesting, and that is the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. It actually was in there from the very beginning. It's in the Constitution from 1787, and it's written in a very flowery way about nobility and princes not conferring emoluments or presents or benefits on the president of the United States or anybody. So if his companies are dealing with a corporation that is essentially an arm of a federal government, and that company confers a benefit on him or even possibly just compensation on a business, it could be considered an emolument and would be in violation of that constitutional provision. There is an out clause, however, and the out clause is Congress can consent to it. So the Congress can essentially give him a waiver.
Wow. There's been a lot of talk of placing his assets in a blind trust, but then he turned around and said, well, my kids will oversee the business, which makes it not a blind trust. What do we know about kind of who will run his business assets now?
Well, he says his kids are going to run it. And, you know, he can call it a blind trust, but it isn't a blind trust. The history is that President Carter, President Reagan, President H.W. Bush, President Clinton, President George W. Bush all put their assets in blind trusts that were administered by an independent trustee, which is how the law reads, the Office of Government Ethics laws read.
And we should note that President Obama did not do that in part because his assets are not that significant at the time. They were in treasury bills and in index funds.
That's correct. He didn't need to do it because he put his money into a highly diversified funds, index funds or government treasuries, that kind of thing, which actually is a great way to go if your holdings are conducive to it. And we handled a good bit of Mayor Bloomberg's assets in that fashion when I represented him. And he has wealth far greater than President-elect Trump. The problem is, in Trump situation, he cannot liquidate his holdings. Many of them are illiquid. They're in the form of golf courses and hotels and a 23% interest in something we don't even know. To disentangle that and liquidate it into something that would be susceptible to a blind trust would take more than 4 years, probably.
Well, so let's say you can't untangle these things. What are the consequences of that?
Well, under the domestic conflict of interest laws, there is no penalty because he is exempt from those laws. I think it will be a constant thorn in his side because people will be making accusations. I mean, he's the president of the United States. The last thing he wants to do is to appear that he's acting unethically, meaning he doesn't want to appear to be acting in his personal financial self-interest in derogation of the public's interest. What he will have to do, first of all, I think, is look at his international holdings, because that's where this emoluments clause comes into play, number one. And number two, I think those are the most sensitive issues, particularly dealing with countries that are essentially enemies, whether it's Russia or China, or at least not friendly countries, or those like Turkey, Azerbaijan, where relationships are sometimes difficult. And if he can disentangle from those holdings, liquidate them, or if it's a debt situation, as was explained regarding the Bank of China, transfer those debts to another institution, work on that first. After that, take a look at his domestic holdings. Are there ones in particular that are going to cause problems? This hotel here in Washington, D.C., which I think he loves and is the centerpiece of his holdings in some regards, is leasing its property from the federal government. In that situation, I think they're going to have to go to great lengths to make sure that whatever government official at the Government Services Administration is administering that property, as the landlord on that property, is going to have to, you know, sort of be in a bubble, if you will, and they'll make sure there's no political or other pressure put on him and that he deals with this situation in an arm's length situation. There's no one size fits all, but they're going to have to address it to abate the possibility of constant scrutiny and criticism.
Ken Gross from Skadden Arps, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
There's a chance you are listening to this on the road, maybe stuck in traffic, maybe returning from a relative's house. So we wanted to share more listener tips and stories about holiday travel. Tim Taylor is 50, from San Diego. His key to staying sane while traveling over the holidays is to take a vacation instead.
Typically, my husband and I, we travel to Hawaii for the Christmas holidays instead of going back east. His family is either in New Jersey or Florida. Mine is in Ohio. It's just easier for us to go to Hawaii, where we don't have to deal with, you know, the normal family dramas, whose side of the family do you go to, that kind of stuff. But we also invite anyone who wants to go out to Hawaii to join us. So, you know, they always have that option. And we typically spend about what we would spend if we would go back east. Another thing we don't have to worry about is any sort of delays due to snowstorms and things like that you can sometimes get when you travel to Christmas holiday time. You know, traveling at the holiday time is stressful for everybody. It's stressful for not only you and your family, but all the other passengers that are traveling as well. And also, you know, the airlines are going to be full. They're going to be busy. They're going to be stressed as well. So just go in with a positive attitude. If things don't necessarily work out the way you wanted them to, your plane gets delayed or something along those lines, just grin and bear it and just try to have a positive attitude and work through it. I think anyone going to Hawaii is typically in a better mood, more so than if they were going to Ohio or New Jersey or some other state, especially if it's a cold weather state during the holidays.
Jennifer Kopf is also 50, and she lives in Tampa, Florida. She says when it comes to traveling with kids, plan, plan, and then plan some more.
I almost never check anything. My son has had his own luggage since he was tiny, like 2 or 3 years old. We got him a little Thomas the Train pull-along, and he has carried his own luggage ever since then. We tend to have luggage packed really early. And the other thing that I do then about packing and getting out the door on time is I usually book really, really early flights, especially when my son was tiny. I would book the earliest flight that I could get, like the crazy 6 a.m. or whatever it was. And then I have to take a taxi to the airport usually. So I would get up and put all of our luggage on the front step and then, you know, only have a couple things to do to close up the house. And when the taxi driver got there, I would ask him to load the luggage into the car. And while he was doing that, I would get my son from bed and he would be sound asleep. And I would just carry him directly to the car, barely half awake. And we were ready to go. And that always worked really well for me. I almost never took, you know, things for myself to read or assumed that I was going to sleep on the plane. You know, we did a lot of interactive things when we were flying. And also for little kids, airports and planes are really fun, exciting places. So we always spent lots of time when we were on the ground looking out the window and, you know, talking about, oh, there's the refueling truck and there's the people bringing the food to the plane. And then even when you're flying, little kids love routine. They love order. And so things like the safety procedures, that little routine that adults all kind of ignore because we've heard it 1,000 times, my son loved that. And when we were flying, we'd pull out the safety feature card from the seat and he'd want to go over it and over it. And I'd point out the exits and he'd point out the exits. And even stuff like bringing the drinks and the food service and then picking up the trash afterwards, he loved that. You know, people get on the plane and they see kids. And they make the most awful faces at you or, you know, grunt or something or go, oh, how old is he? And I can't tell you the number of times that we would, at the other end of the flight, those same passengers would say something like, what a good traveler. It was always kind of infuriating, actually, because, you know, I think that kids want to do well. You know, they want to behave. They need to have some attention or they need to have a thing to do. And when they're stuck in a seat like that, you know, it's a great time to interact with your kid.
To wrap up our holiday travel advice, we talked with Brian Kelly. He's the founder and CEO of thepointsguy.com and an authority on how to actually use airline and credit card rewards. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is a hard time to book travel, much less rewards travel. Are there still ways to do it?
There are absolutely still ways to do it. You know, there's this big myth that just because it's a busy holiday travel season that you can't use your miles. And that's just false. And actually, because so many business travelers stay home, there's actually a lot of availability in the front of the cabin as well. So it could be a good time to upgrade.
Well, so how do you do that? Like, how do you ensure that you know, get that upgrade or get the good seat using miles?
Well, simply, you can just go to airline websites and check for award availability. Instead of just assuming there is none, airlines actually make a lot available even the week of travel. So if you're a procrastinator, you know, airfares are sky high last minute because they want to gouge people who didn't plan. Yet at the same time, the airlines release a lot of that last minute award seat availability using your miles. So always check on the website or call to see if there's partner availability that the airlines don't show online.
Do you have to be a sort of a loyalist to one airline or another to get the good stuff?
Absolutely not. You know, some airlines may give a little bit more award availability to their elite members, but in general, you don't need to have elite status to get the best availability. But the big trick is sometimes it makes sense to call because certain airline websites won't show partner award availability. For example, American Airlines, you can redeem on Qatar and Etihad, but you have to call if you want to book on those airlines. So don't assume that whatever you see on the airline website is everything that's available.
So you just have to kind of put in a little more legwork.
Exactly. But that legwork can pay off dramatically, especially since, you know, airfares can be high, especially last minute.
Yeah. And, you know, at this season, we all feel like we're sardines.
Yeah.
Are there places to go or deals to be found if you are willing to do kind of the overlooked destination or the off-season place?
Absolutely. It's all about off-season. Well, you know, especially over the the Christmas and New Year holiday, Europe is looking as attractive as ever, especially with, you know, the U.S. dollar strong. And there are so many cheap airlines. You know, Norwegian Airlines is expanding like crazy to the U.S. market. So you can get, you know, under $500 round trip. And there's a trick when you book Norwegian, book it through their website in Norwegian. And if you book in Norwegian kroner, you save almost 20% on the airfare.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, Iceland, you know, people think, you know, it's cold in the winter. Yeah, but it's also incredibly beautiful. So you can also, you know, fly WOW Air, the new low-cost Icelandic carrier that's expanding in the U.S. on the way to Europe, stop in Iceland and, you know, go see those northern lights.
If you're not a loyalist to one airline, like, do these sort of rack up the points cards make a difference?
Yeah, you know, the credit cards these days are as lucrative as ever. You know, Chase just came out with this reserve card with 100,000 points just for getting it, which, you know, is $1,500 minimum, if not more, when you transfer to partners. So, you know, what I would say is don't put all your miles in one basket. Don't just fly one airline and get one airline credit card. Get cards that allow you to transfer points and earn at a really good ratio.
Are there ways to, like, bank or accumulate points quickly?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way is by credit cards, right? So getting a huge sign-up bonus and then thinking about what you spend your money on and putting that on the right credit card. Don't just earn 1 point or mile per dollar spent. There's so many cards out there that give bonuses, especially during the holiday shopping season. Online shopping portals. So airlines and hotels will actually give you extra miles and points for shopping through their portals. So instead of going to, you know, Target.com, shop through these airline portals. It takes you directly to the retailer website and you earn extra miles.
Brian Kelly, CEO of The Points Guy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Safe travels.
Now we've got a new marketplace quiz. That's when we ask actors, musicians, writers, and other people in the spotlight to share their stories about work, money, and the lessons they've learned. Producer Raghu Manavalan has this week's guest.
Hi, I'm Zoe Deschanel, and I am an actor and musician.
So first question, in a next life, what would your career be?
In a next life? Well, it's hard to say because there are, like, things that I feel like I could do now, maybe. But making children's clothing.
Are we talking toddler level, baby?
Baby through toddler.
Excellent. Excellent.
I have a toddler and the clothing, you know, the clothes are so cute. So. And I made her some little outfits before she was born that are really sweet. So.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
One of those vacuums that's like a robot vacuum.
A Roomba?
Yeah.
Huh. I've just heard good things, so you're the first person ever.
Oh, yeah,
no.
People love it. It's a great product. It's just not. I just got really into the idea of it, and then I haven't used it. And then one night, I think my nephew came over and was playing with it or something. And then one night, I hear this, like, terrifying screeching noise. And I walk out, and there's, like, a light coming from the living room. I'm like, what is going on? Is there an alien invasion? I walked downstairs and it was the Roomba, just like, I guess my nephew had pressed some buttons or something.
The robot apocalypse uprising button, apparently.
Yeah.
When did you realize being a musician and actor could be an actual paying career?
In high school. I grew up in LA, so I started auditioning for movies and television in high school. And then I also sang, you know, I did some, like, club shows and stuff and made, like, you know, $40 singing. So mm-hmm. I was like, all right, that was fun, and I made some cash.
And I bought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
What is your most prized possession?
Define possession.
You tell me. I mean, it could be a tangible item. It could be a memory. I don't know.
A microphone that Brian Wilson gave to me. I sang on his record, and then he gave me the mic that I recorded with.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Waking up at 5 in the morning most days.
What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
I feel a little bit hesitant to suggest that everyone should own something no matter the cost. I mean, I would say a coffee maker, but not everyone loves coffee.
Everyone should love coffee, though.
Yeah, so everyone should have a coffee maker. And or make it for friends.
Last question. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
I think I may have had this piece of advice, but I'm not sure that it was, like, very loud and clear. But I wish someone had really drilled it in that you should always be true to your own self and tastes and not get too carried away with pleasing other people. I try my best to do that. You can't always. There's a give and take, and anytime you're being, you know, paid to do something or you're collaborating with a lot of people, there are gonna be some compromises that you make. But you should at least, you know, try. And I think at the beginning, when I first started, it was a little bit more confusing. And then once I sort of really discovered that, then you know you can always kind of stand by things you do. Because if you like it, then, you know.
Deschanel's band, She and Him, recently released their latest album, Christmas Party. We heard earlier from Lindsay Turrentine about the growth of online retail and mobile shopping. But if you're logging in to shop on Monday from an airport, a train station, or any type of public Wi-Fi connection, you might want to be extra careful. The tech landscape changes quickly, and so does how we protect ourselves online. Chester Wisniewski is a principal research scientist at the cybersecurity firm Sophos, and he's got some advice. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So we are approaching the holiday season. You know, we've got online shopping, lots of traveling. It feels like there are a lot of potential security pitfalls out there. Are there kind of a few ground rules for staying safe online?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, whether we're shopping online or we're shopping in real life, I guess, you know, we're pretty connected to the internet these days. So a lot of people might be tempted, say, to connect to that Wi-Fi at the mall while they're doing their Christmas shopping. It's one of those things to be aware of, that those open Wi-Fi access points out there, they're generally not secure, and it's very easy for people to spy on your activity. So if you've got a good data plan from your cell phone provider, it's probably, you know, maybe worth not connecting to that mall Wi-Fi and just, you know, using your Verizon or your T-Mobile, et cetera, instead, where you've got a little more security and safety.
Well, okay, yeah, but like, what if I'm sitting waiting for a plane and I don't have the choice? Should I set up a VPN on my phone? That's one of those things I have to admit. I'm like, oh, that seems so tiring and hard.
Yeah, I think part of that's depending on, you know, how paranoid you really want to be about your security. I think, you know, VPN services are great, but they're not very convenient often, and a lot of people don't like to have to remember to turn them on, and you have to subscribe and this type of the thing. And I'm a fan of just using the web browser on my phone. You know, the security we use today in our web browsers is pretty high grade, and I think it's perfectly safe to do that shopping through your web browser on your phone. What I would avoid is maybe using some of these bespoke applications for your bank or a particular store. So maybe rather than using the Amazon app, maybe you just go to Amazon.com in your browser. And I think that's probably a safe approach.
So if you are willing to set up a VPN, can you walk me through how to do that for my phone?
Sure. I mean, generally, it's just a matter of installing an app from the iOS App Store or from the Google Play Store on your device, and then subscribing to a VPN service from one of the many different providers that you can, you know, use your favorite search engine to find. And, you know, like many apps, you have to type in your username and your password. And that's generally all that's involved. Many of them even offer a sort of auto start feature where, you know, no matter what you're doing, they automatically turn themselves on. And what it's really doing is it's ensuring that Wi-Fi connection between your phone and the access point, that nobody else standing around you is able to see the content. But keep in mind, I mean, everything you do ultimately is visible to the provider of that VPN service. So you have to decide where to place your trust.
So what if you're listening to this and you think, okay, you know what, I'm actually willing to invest a little time and effort to make things safer. What's kind of the medium level step?
Well, certainly, you know, keeping all your stuff up to date is really critical. There's vulnerabilities in a lot of the products that we use on our computers and on our tablets and cell phones. And when those, you know, dialogues come up and beg us to install these updates, we're often, you know, inconvenienced because we're in the middle of doing something important, like shopping. So it is really important to do those things. And especially it's important to do them generally within, you know, 24 to 48 hours of being notified by them. So also, you know, remember that a lot of the information you're being asked for isn't necessary. You know, almost every website or place I go to shop seems to want my birthday and my postal code or my zip code or these kinds of things. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it's not needed, right? So don't share information where you don't need to share it. And probably the most impact that is a little inconvenient, but it makes a huge difference in safety and security is have a different password on all those different sites you're accessing. And whether you're going to use a password management tool to help you with that process, or whether you feel like you need to write them down and put them in a notebook and hide them in the drawer in your den or in your purse or in your wallet or something, I'd rather you have different passwords and write them down than to share a password, because that's leading to a lot of compromise.
There have been a number of sort of encrypted apps and messaging services that have sprung up. Signal is one, for example. Do you think those are worth it?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly work really well. With privacy, it's always kind of a trade of convenience. So if you want to have a private conversation, then maybe it's not going to pop up on all 11 of your smart devices around. You know, it's more of a one-on-one type of conversation. But I use those messengers, and I find them to be incredibly convenient and easy to use. And the engineering that's gone into them provides a very high level of security and safety.
Chester Wisniewski, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanksgiving, I tend to be a pretty big turkey sandwich person because there's just so much good stuff left over to put in them. And Thanksgiving is one of those rare occasions where we actually plan for leftovers. But you can be more creative than my little sandwiches. Plus, take that same planning for leftovers approach and apply it to your regular meals. We are going to do that with a chef who focuses on sustainability. Melissa King was a finalist on Top Chef and now works as a chef ambassador with Whole Foods. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Thanksgiving is one of those holidays where, depending on how you plan it, you can really generate a lot of leftovers. What are your favorite Thanksgiving leftovers?
My favorite Thanksgiving leftovers it's the actual turkey carcass. And what I do with this is I take it and I make bone broth with it. So I make like a turkey stock. And I use that stock to make porridge. So we have like turkey porridge the next day.
What goes into turkey porridge?
So you like sweat down some garlic and onions. Then you put some rice in there. And then you put enough liquid to kind of cover all the rice. And you just slowly cook that down. And it turns into a really kind of loose porridge, kind of like a soup. But it's really delicious. It's like a classic Cantonese style dish that I grew up on. It just has a lot of great flavor, and then you can shred up some of the meat that's left over from your turkey and throw that in.
You throw out porridge. Tell me a few other things you like to do with Thanksgiving leftovers.
I love sandwiches, so I'm always like carving up turkey, trying to make really fun sandwiches. Like I'll, you know, utilize the cranberry sauce and throw that in there. Another great tip is to take all your roasted vegetables, and you can make quiche out of it and just kind of like throw them all in, or you can use it for omelets in the morning. Basically, I treat the turkey as if it's chicken, and like, where would I put chicken, you know? So like, if I'm making salad, maybe I'll do like a turkey cob salad. So there's a lot of ways to really just like think outside the box of how to use your leftovers.
You know, this is one of those holidays where I think people really lean into the existence of leftovers. But you also focus so much on sustainability. I guess I wonder, is Thanksgiving different in that we think about planning ahead for kind of the aftermath? Or should we be planning all of our meals like that if we're thinking about an eye toward sustainability and also affordability?
I think we should always plan that way. Even restaurants, you know, we tend to order, you know, we order our food for the restaurant, and then there's always residual like scrap and trim, and we try not to waste anything. You know, it's really all about using, you know, your bones to make sauce and broth. If you have scrap pieces of fish from butchery, you know, you can make a fish stew with it. So I think it's important that we continue to think about, you know, how can we use what's left over and turn it into another meal and have it keep going.
So if you had to sort of put yourself on, I guess, a sustainability scale, I feel like one way to do it is to really kind of plan down to the item and buy very minimally. And the other way is to think about how to use everything. It sounds like you're on the use everything scale.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you definitely only want to buy what you need. I try to purchase things every like 2 or 3 days. I'm all about freshness here. So, you know, I try to go to the farmer's market and source things that, you know, look fresh and then use them within 1 or 2 days. And then I'll go back to the market and replenish. But yeah, try not to buy everything like all at once. Because then a lot of stuff spoils and then that just goes in the garbage. So I think it's important to, you know, if you do have leftovers that can carry over, it's really important to be able to think about ways you can be creative and, you know, turn it into another dish.
Well, if you're listening to this and you don't have the chance to go to a farmer's market and pick up 1 or 2 fresh things, what are ways to think about kind of bringing in the best ingredients that are also affordable into your diet?
It's about making the right choices and really looking at what can you buy that can store a little longer on your shelf. But also, you know, like for myself, I this is talking about a whole different thing about sustainability, but there's a sustainable fish watch list. It's the seafood watch list that you can look up online. I think it's the Monterey Aquarium website. And that kind of breaks down all the types of fish around the world, of what's being overharvested and what's, you know, considered safe. So yeah, I think a lot of it is just making those right choices for the environment and for your family.
When you are in that moment where you cannot bear to look at another piece of turkey, what's your go-to kind of reset the clock meal?
Yeah, for myself, I mean, after indulging, even when I go on work trips, I have to like constantly eat and, you know, experience the food of that region. And it just burns me out a lot. So when I get home, I usually just stick to vegetables and I just like binge on vegetables, some whole grain, and maybe like a little bit of protein. So it's kind of more like a paleo diet, where there's not too much dairy and gluten going on.
You also plan meals for and advise Whole Foods. And I guess I wonder, when we think about the way Americans eat in 2016, do you think it's shifting? Or are we thinking with an eye towards sustainability? Or is that only in kind of rarefied pockets?
I do think that we are starting to become more aware. I do see a lot of people becoming more aware of what they're eating and what they're putting in their bodies, where they're sourcing it from, whether or not it's organic or GMO-free. So, yeah, I do see people really starting to shift and eat more towards the healthy side.
Melissa King, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we are going to continue our dive into the economic stories surrounding President-elect Trump. What would you like to know? Visit marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.